Welcome to part two of our conversation with Jeff Belanger about The Devil Made Me Do It. So they're bringing this up. I mean, and what an interesting thing to bring up. I mean, I can't imagine they were ever, you know, sitting there, you know, plotting, oh, someday we can bring this up in court. But I mean, this happens. And then you're like, oh, well,
you know what? Hold on. Let me correct you, Tony.
Yeah.
So they're not, you said they're not just plotting. Maybe someday we can bring this up in court. They were.
Oh, really?
And not with this case.
Okay.
Because I could tell you, I've spoken with Ed about this extensively. Mm-hmm. One of the cases he was most proud of, this is a sidebar here, everybody, so stay with me. Sidebar. Ed got involved with another case in Connecticut where the woman moved into a haunted apartment, and she was freaked out all the time, and she wanted out of her lease. Her landlord wouldn't let her out of her lease, and it actually went before a judge. And the Warrens came in and told the judge, hey, this place was previously haunted. The landlord rented it knowing that. This tenant rented the place not knowing that, and therefore should not be held to the lease. The judge ruled, okay, yeah, she shouldn't be held to this lease, but the judge wasn't ruling on ghosts. The judge was ruling on a stigmatized property.
Okay.
And there's lots of ways a property gets stigmatized. For example, the Amityville house in Long Island is a stigmatized property because six people were murdered in it.
Sure.
And now it's famous for the movies and all the other stuff. So that house has a stigma. It must be disclosed to you if you're going to rent or buy it. That's the cut and dry thing. So for Ed, this was like, I proved in court of law that ghosts exist. Well, you proved that stigmatized properties exist, but that was already proven. So anyway, they were hell bent on getting their work into a court anyway.
Okay.
And I think for them, this was a huge opportunity with Arne Johnson. But this is way bigger than getting out of a lease because there's some, you know, weird cold spots and knocks on the wall. This is huge.
Mm-hmm. So they begin to look at this and they get involved and the arguments begin. I mean, how does this path continue?
So they're getting all the stuff together. The court of public opinion, of course, has the first hearing before it ever gets before a judge. The court, just like today, this is, you know, this isn't radically different. The court of public opinion begins to deliberate in the press, in newspapers, in video magazine shows, and local TV networks and stuff like that. And it's great. You can see some of the old footage where you see man on the street interviews with like, well, what do you think about this? Devil made me do it. Oh, I think it's absolutely ridiculous. And then the reporter asks, well, do you believe in God? Well, of course, I'm a good Christian. I go to church. Well, then do you believe in the devil? Yeah. And you can see the discomfort start to come over man on the street, right? You know, it's like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess I don't know. So suddenly it's sort of changing. People are going, oh, man, what if?
Mm-hmm.
And So the court of public opinion takes over. But then once it actually gets before the judge, Judge Robert Callahan, the second he opens the trial, the very first thing he says, March 19th, 1981, is, hey, by the way, I will not be hearing any sort of evidence about demons or devils. This is not about whether they exist or don't exist. It's actually irrelevant to this case. And that was that. They never got to present any of it in the court of law. And Marty Minella at that point had to completely change his approach from devil made him do it. He was under demonic possession to, this is manslaughter. These are two drunk guys who got in a fight. And my client, was drunk.
Yeah. So is it obviously then it can't be argued in court. But what is the opinion from that point forward still of Arne, of the family, of, I'd be curious on both sides of the case, the family of Arne and the victim, because both have to be looking at this from some perspective. I don't know if it's opposing or the same thought process.
So Arnie's position from the moment he was arrested was, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I don't remember this. I have no memory of it. And by the way, still that's still his position today.
Yeah.
He sort of consistently said, I don't have a recollection of this event. At one point, he sort of said, I recognize my hand was on the knife and stuck it into Alan Bono, and Alan Bono died. Like, he acknowledges that. Mm-hmm. However, I don't think I was under my own power. And so whether the court of public opinion weighed on this or not, I don't know. But ultimately, he's not found guilty of murder, but he's found guilty of manslaughter. Mm-hmm. And manslaughter, he was to serve a 10 to 20 year sentence, and he actually only served 5 for good behavior.
This is, I mean, it's so compelling because Arnie was on the documentary on Discovery Plus that you were on,
yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
Which was very interesting. Did, to this day, what is his opinion on this? Does he look at this as blackout drunk, just doing things people do dumb things blackout drunk and they're not possessed? Or does he believe that he himself, that there was something paranormal involved that goes back to the case with David and whatever was affecting him?
This is really hard. Have you seen the documentary?
I did.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I hate to turn your question back on you, but at the same time, if you made this horrible decision at some point in your life where you took another person's life, mm-hmm. And you went to jail for it and you were drunk, they were drunk. It was all a horrible, terrible night.
Yeah.
At some point, do you sort of rewrite the narrative in your head over the years? That was not me. Cause I would never do that. I'm a good person. I would never kill another person. Do you rewrite the narrative or is that what you believed from the beginning?
Yeah.
It's hard to, I don't know. I don't know.
It is hard because, as a human being, just to continue to get by, mentally, our minds are going to try and come up with things for coping and for trying to get by and make sense of things. And if this narrative is presented to you, it wouldn't be that far of a stretch to start to believe it, even if at the beginning you did not.
Sure.
But
right.
I guess that's the real question is, and only Arnie can really answer it. And I don't know if you've ever heard an answer from him on this would be, did he believe that from the beginning? Did he believe from the beginning that there was something else at play here beyond just being blackout drunk?
I think it's worth noting that to me, one of the most interesting points to make is the police officer that arrested him just mm-hmm. a couple hours after the event said he was literally wandering in the woods and confused and came peacefully. There was no argument. There was no, what are you talking about? Just, hey, why don't you come with us? Mm-hmm. Okay. If someone had committed murder and was running for it, that doesn't sound like a reaction that, you know what I mean? Like that's not, is that you would say, I'd run. No, you're not going to take me alive. Something, you wouldn't just say like, yeah, sure. Of course I'll come with you. So I don't know.
So he was completely unaware that he even killed anybody at this point of being arrested.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you were aware, you just stabbed somebody and now you see a cop approaching you.
Yeah.
Like, any logical person would say, I'm clearly caught. I just did this 2 hours ago. So for him to be confused, I think is worth noting. But to me, the even bigger discussion here is the ethics of what Ed and Lorraine Warren did. Mm-hmm. Right. Dozens of people would back me up on this. Ed and Lorraine Warren love the paranormal and they love the subject, but they also love the media.
Sure.
And they love the attention. And Ed would tell you that without apology. I've interviewed him about it where he said, look, this is before the internet, before you could like YouTube yourself or live stream yourself doing your own investigation. Ed would invite reporters of all kinds to come with him on investigations because he wanted to prove his work. He wanted people to see what he does.
Yeah.
So for him, it was about getting a lot of attention for this subject. But I feel the need to remind everybody, a man died, mm-hmm. Like Alan Bono died. And what if Alan was your husband, brother, son, cousin, friend, you want justice. And not only that, had Judge Callahan said, sure, let's run down this road and play it out. he would have created a nightmare for every single judge in the United States of America.
Yeah.
All of them, 100% without exception, because anytime someone else committed a murder, they would forget a murder. How about like assault, anything? You'd be like, oh, it wasn't me. The devil made me do it.
Yeah. What was there ever an opinion released from the family of Alan Bono on the just the idea of this attempted to be brought into court, the idea that the devil made me do it? Did they ever express disgust or agreement or anything about it?
Yeah, so we don't really hear much from Alan's family. I don't think he was married or had kids or anything. You get the sense he was sort of off on his own. He had lived in Australia for a bunch of years mm-hmm. before this, and so you don't really hear from that side on the story. But still, I think we live in a society where we understand a person deserves justice.
Yeah.
And I mean, we all understand rage. You know, we've mm-hmm. all driven in rush hour traffic.
Sure.
Right. Right. And you know, there's that moment where it's happened to all of us. I don't care who you are. Where like someone just cuts you off and you grip the steering wheel and you're like, oh, I would kill you. Right.
Yeah.
But you don't actually kill them. You just sort of think it for a moment and mm-hmm. you let that out. You know, you just sort of, okay,
yeah.
Take a breath, you know, listen to your podcast, calm down, get to where you're going.
Sure.
But sometimes people do act on those impulses. Mm-hmm. And I remember, so working on Ghost Adventures, we've done a lot of prisons and I've interviewed a lot of corrections officers and wardens. And I remember hearing from a correction officer once talking about how it's weird when you look at some of these inmates. He's like, you realize the difference between you and them is like literally like 15 seconds. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, in a span of probably about 15 seconds, this person made a decision, a horrible choice, an accident that forever changed their life. And now they're in here on this side of the cage. And I'm out here on the outside of the cage. And he's like, under different circumstances, we would be fishing buddies. Mm-hmm. And he's like, however, there's the other kind of person. They were just born bad and they're going to do bad things. And the best we can do is just keep them locked up in here.
Yeah.
And I said, I get it. I get that some people just sort of give in to this one moment. And so maybe that's and if you want to say, yeah, I was in a blind rage, I was out of my mind, that may be so. But you let yourself get there. Mm-hmm. And so you still must be held accountable.
Sure.
You know what I mean? That's my position anyway, is that even if the devil made you do it, you let yourself get to that point.
Yeah.
And thus you're ultimately responsible.
And even if you take the devil out of it, I mean, if you're inebriated, your inhibitions, your judgment, all that goes way down. So where you may have been sober, you wouldn't have stabbed him. When you're that gone, that may seem like the best thing to do at that moment. It may be something, again, you would never, ever do. But because of that, that made you do it. And it can be argued so easily, you know, that direction as well.
Sure.
The other thing that I want to ask about with this is this girlfriend at the time. At some point, she says that the knife was glowing after yes. it was on the ground and came out. I guess the timeline as to when that statement was made plays a big role in this as far as, you know, where, you know, when was that observed or reported, prior to Ed and Lorraine being involved or after?
So, I mean, before Ed and Lorraine said, hey, let's go with this defense.
Yes.
So, you know, and by the way, let me throw out another option. After it was all played out and Arnie was in jail and they were writing the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Maybe that, right? Could it have been there?
Sure.
That this little nugget comes out for the sake of, I don't know. I mean, you know, if you read the book that came out, I think it was 1983, which is, you know, just by the time you write a book and get it published, I mean, that's about right there.
Yeah.
Anyway, it just sort of all kind of like comes together. Is it for the sake of story? Is this rewriting it, you know, post event? We don't know, because any story like this is going to evolve and change once it, you know, once it gets into the public sphere, you mm-hmm. know, and once people are, you know, talking about it. And by the way, it was made into a movie. I didn't even realize this. Kevin Bacon. It was like one of Kevin Bacon's first movies. This was like 1984. This terrible B movie about this case.
Yeah.
was made like 1984 or 1985. You can actually watch it on YouTube.
It was like a made for TV one, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was awful, right? Totally awful. But and then that was that. And people would have thought that was the end of it. But then, of course, the Conjuring franchise was so popular that they chose this movie to be the next one. And it just came out, you know, whatever, last month, right? So
yeah. And, you know, I was really surprised, you know, by the movie, by actually how the many elements of the story were portrayed in the movie pretty well in terms of timeline and such. Because I ended up watching, my order of this one was way off than what I normally do. I normally learn about the case and then watch the movie. I watched the movie and then I watched the doc and then learned much more about the case. And when I was watching the movie initially, my reaction was, oh my God, this is so far out there. And there are elements of the movie where I think they borderline portray Ed and Lorraine as almost superheroes. I was waiting for Ed to like rip his shirt open and then Lorraine to like have her eyes glow and like have beams come out of them. And it's like suddenly they're crossing Conjuring with Marvel or something. But it was, as far as some of the order of timeline and events, I was surprised how much was accurate in the movie, because I was thinking this one is way off. I felt it for a Conjuring movie compared to the first one. Like, I felt like we're going a little too off the tracks here on the Conjuring 3. But it really, other than them almost becoming superheroes, wasn't that far off of portraying this story in a certain way. But I'm just wondering about it as all of this, you know, kind of unfolds and we hear these stories, is, you know, how accurate, you know, to reality in your opinion, you know, is, you know, was this movie? Because you are much more informed on this one than I was.
Yeah. So the movie, so the first movie, the first Conjuring movie, was like not even in the realm of what happened, right? Like, okay, Perrin family, house in Rhode Island, and that's it. That's where it ends, you know?
Yeah.
And in that one, Ed and Lorraine Warren were the heroes and who saved the day. And in reality, Ed got punched in the mouth and was told to get the hell out of the house and never come back.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
And so, so in this one, one of the elements they introduced was this whole like satanic cult thing. And that, I get it from a story perspective. You need a reason. You asked yourself earlier, you said, why did this thing pick this kid? Like, why this family? Why this, was it just wrong place? And the reality is it's just kind of like wrong place at the wrong time, which, by the way, I find way scarier.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's what made one of the things that made the Exorcist movie so scary was that Reagan wasn't doing anything. She's just a kid.
Yeah.
And this thing latched onto her and that's, you know, she didn't deserve it. Speaking of Exorcist, it is important to note that movie came out in 1973 and this event took place in 1980. So that movie was still on the minds of the public.
Sure.
And you sort of have to put things into a cultural perspective. And we didn't talk about that before, but that does sort of play on everybody, on the newspapers, on the public, on the family going through it, on the priests, everything. So I think like the movie, and sorry, minor spoiler here, you know, just about playing up this whole satanic cult angle, they were looking for some sort of reason where in reality there was none.
Let me ask you this, and they will close with this one. I'm very curious on this case, because there's almost two parts to this. There's the initial case with David and the church getting involved and that exorcism and things calming down, and then we have, you know, part two almost, where we have the murder with Arnie Johnson and Alan Bono being involved. What is your opinion on, you know, the legitimacy of, I guess, you know, the argument that the devil made him do it? The first part I can understand. I can believe that story of those things happening with Ed and Lorraine and the investigation. That seems to be, you know, not as far-fetched. But what do you think about the second part to this, which is ultimately the crux of the whole story?
Yeah, it falls apart there for me. When you watch the documentary and you see Debbie crying, remembering what her brother went through. Like, I believe that family went through something profound. And if the church was involved, they don't just throw out exorcisms. Yeah. I know that that's a whole process. So I really believe that first part is pretty authentic. The second part, I think, feels a lot more opportunistic to me. And I think the judge made the absolute correct call, not allowing this line of defense at all, because quite frankly, we've been here before, right? A little place called Salem, Massachusetts in 1692.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Where it was called spectral evidence. And back then we were England. We were not the United States then. We were England. And that case was such a miscarriage of justice that it changed laws. It changed laws on both sides of the Atlantic. That, like, spectral evidence, no more. No more spectral evidence in courts. Forget it. This is ridiculous. You know, that's not appropriate. And so the legal system really moved on from that. And so the judge's position was kind of like, I don't care who made you do it. If your hand was on the knife and a man is now dead, those are the facts I'm dealing with. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to argue that you might have had reason or some defense or whatever, like, we can do that. That's something that we're used to, and we can talk about that and put it before a jury. But for you to suggest that, yeah, my hand killed the guy, but I wasn't in my body, a demon was, I can't put that demon on trial and I won't have it. And I think I would have done the same exact thing if I was that judge.
It's impossible to put words in the mouths of Ed or Lorraine, obviously, with them being gone now. But what's your opinion? Do you believe up until the end that they believed their argument on this? Do you think they ever changed opinions?
No, I think they were pretty, you know, the Warrens really came at this from a Roman Catholic perspective. Mm-hmm. They would tell you, we'll work with any religious clergy, and that's true. However, at the end of the day, they're Roman Catholics. They went in with holy water and crosses. These were their literally weapons. Ed viewed himself as a warrior against evil and to prove evil exists and document it and fight it. And so I think for Ed, this was just another chapter in that book of him taking the battle to the demons, of raising awareness in the public. And so I think he looked right past the whole fact that a man died to, well, the greater good is that I prove my life's work and demons are real and Catholicism's important and go to church and pray and, you know, turn to people like me when you get into trouble. I don't think they ever changed position on that.
That wraps up part two of our conversation with Jeff Belanger about The Devil Made Me Do It. A big thank you to you for supporting our program and keeping us on the air today. We could not do this without your help. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.